John, you still there?
Okay, good. All right, good morning to both of you. Hope you had a good week.
It was a good week. And you?
Yes, thank God.
Good.
We've mentioned last time, we would maybe discuss a little bit about Bilam. So we could either do that. There's also another piece of Gemara I was taking a look at, which was quite interesting regarding some conversations that took place between the Romans and the rabbis about 2,000 years ago regarding idolatry. And we could actually do both, take a little time for both. So if you want, I just want to maybe give a few broad strokes in terms of Bilam, since we were talking about it last week, and we mentioned we'd take a take a look at that just to see what was going on in terms of the prophecy. You know, this is a wicked person getting prophecy at that, which is, you know, an oddity.
That sounds good.
All right, so that is located in, if you want to take a look, in Parshas, Numbers 23. The first prophecy is 23:7 in Numbers. Okay, so if you want, why don't you read the first, for just one moment, just in terms of a backdrop. So the Rabbi Chaya had given a class on Bilam, a number of them actually, and the one concept that he'd mentioned was that Bilam was, of course, you know, you can't curse. The ability, Bilam's fame, and Balak was the king of Moab, and he saw the Jews coming, and a large amount of people. He didn't want them coming through his land, destroying his property, whatever it was, and he felt that cursing them could change their fate, that this is a real, truly accepted, idolatrous feeling. And Bilam knew that he couldn't do anything, but Rabbi Chaya explained that Bilam had a very good insight, and he was able to see when somebody or people were about to have a negative event happening just by looking at the situations and all factors. He was able to calculate very accurately when people or an individual would have a downfall or whether they would have a increase in fame and success. And if he had pronounced a curse, and the fate of the Jews would have gone downhill, it would be attributed to Bilam. So that was something which was trying to be avoided, so it shouldn't look like that the Jews are just under this type of a curse, and this is how the world works. It would give a bad impression. So this was avoided. God did not allow him to curse. So the anything negative that was supposed to happen to the Jews, nothing did happen at this time. I believe that's one of the commentaries state. And additionally, anything, all three attempts of Bilam were thwarted. He was not able to pronounce anything, and he had to actually have whatever words God put into his mouth, he had to speak. As a separate question, of course, that somebody asked, is that a tampering with free will, that if Bilam wanted to actually curse, and God gave him a prophecy. I mean, we know that it's a principle. God never takes away free will. Even by Paro in Egypt, he didn't take away free will. But he has one that I think was, I'm not sure if it was the Briskerov or who had mentioned it, to what exactly took place over there. Why Paro, it says in the verses that God hardened his heart. It means that he did not allow him to be impressed with the miracles. So he stayed in his obstinate nature, whereas a typical person would have been overcome by the miracles and he would have let the Jews go. So he allowed Paro to continue at his own free will without being impressed with the miracles. So it wasn't a tampering of the free will there either. He didn't allow him to repent, but Paro was the one who chose this path to begin with. So here as well, you could ask the question, did God take away any free will? If Bilam wanted a curse, and now he had to have a prophecy. And just to address that briefly, there's a statement in the prophet Amos that states the following. And this is... Amos chapter 3, and it's verse 8. And it says as follows. It says, if a lion roars, who would not be afraid? And if God gives a prophecy, who will not prophesize? So it's equating the impossibility of a man to hold his peace of mind when a lion is roaring right in front of him. That's impossible. A person's going to be terrified. His life is on the line. So just as a person is going to have a response of being terrified at the roar of a lion, so also it's impossible for a person not to have prophecy if God gives it to him. Equally true, it's impossible not to bleed if your skin is cut. Now if we say that, so that means to say that it's not a matter of free will. It's just a matter of a natural result. There are certain natures that exist, and your free will does not play a role. Your free will has nothing to do with you bleeding if you get cut. It's not an issue of free will. There's no free will when a lion is roaring right in front of you. That is not an issue of free will. That's just a natural response. You still have your free will, but it's impossible not to be afraid. That's just the way we are wired. So equally true is that it's impossible that if God has a prophecy, and again, we don't have prophecy, so we're just repeating what the Navi, what the prophet says here. So, but why is it impossible? We don't know. But the fact is, we see that there are impossibilities. You cannot do certain things, and it's not an issue of free will. So here also with prophecy, it would be impossible not to have the prophecy. So it's not an issue of free will by Bilam. And we can base it again on this verse in Amos that equates the impossibility to hold your countenance in front of a roaring lion. It's also impossible to not prophesy if God sends you. Okay, so from here it's clear that it's not an issue of free will by Bilam. All right, so I just wanted to address that because that was a good question. But luckily I recalled this one verse. I believe it's the last verse of a Haftorah. That's why I remember it. Usually that last verse is something which you recall well. It's the last thing that the person reading the Torah on Saturday morning says, so it sticks in your mind longer. Okay. Now, let's just take a look. Just a few points by Bilam and Balak. If you go through the story, you'll see that there were about three times that Balak wanted Bilam to curse after he finally lured him there and promised him wealth and all this. And so Balak, the king of Moab, asks Bilam to curse on three different occasions, and he doesn't do it. And each time, he tries a different attempt, and there's a different dialogue going on. And God gives three prophecies to Bilam to tell to Balak, the king of Moab. So the question initially is, were these three essential from the outset? That God had these three messages that had to be given to Balak? Or was each subsequent prophecy a response to the current dialogue between Balak and Bilam? And it would seem to be the latter. So if you look at the first prophecy, the first message. So Bilam gets a prophecy from God, and God tells him he has to say this to Balak, the king. And he says to him that from Aram, Balak has taken me, the king of Moab, from the mountains of Kedem of the east. He says to me, "Come curse Jacob." And Ulecha Zoma Yisrael. another type of a curse. And curse Israel. Okay. So, you know, this is the beginning of the actual prophecy that Bilaam is now delivering to Balak. And then he says, this is Numbers 23:8, how can one curse that who is not cursed by God? And how can I revile those who God does not revile or curse? So he says, this can't be done, Balak. I cannot curse them because God has not cursed them. And then he says in verse 9, the next verse, the next part of the prophecy, he says, Ki, because. Merosh Tsurim, from the top of the Tsurim, like a tsar, is what, like a rock. I have seen them, and from the valleys. Asherenu. So he says, the reasoning why I can't curse them, so it's just a little enigmatic, but Rashi comes to the aid, and he says that the reason why they can't be cursed is because they are strong as rocks and valleys through the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Interesting statement. And he also says afterwards, who can count Jacob? And the number of the and the number, I guess their number is like the sand, he says. And he says that is Rashi again comes in and says Dabrach, another explanation for this. The sand of Jacob. There's no counting of the mitzvahs that they do. For example, it says the mitzvahs that are done in the sand. So what are the mitzvahs that are done, the commands that are done in the sand? I mean, the mitzvahs, the commands that are fulfilled in the earth. They don't plow with mixed species. They don't plant mixed species. They use the dust for the red heifer. And for the when they try the unfaithful wife, they have to take dust from the ground as part of the procedure to try the woman, and similar things. But his two points are is that the Jews can't be cursed because God has not cursed them, and the reasoning is why they're not cursed, because they have the patriarchs and matriarchs that are solid as rocks, and the Jews do the commands. So what is the first message that Bilaam is now delivering to Balak?
Be that. That he's saying these people are following God's will, and so therefore they're not curseable, if you will.
So what is the understanding? So there's an unstated message here. What was Balak, the king, his intent?
Well, he wanted to curse them because he was concerned that they were going to overcome or destroy him.
All right.
Right?
But there's some unexamined theory of Balak, isn't there?
Is it that he thinks that there's a power in cursing?
Right. He thinks that there's a power in cursing. Now, there's also the response that Bilaam is giving him. What is Bilaam's content? What is he talking about? Meaning, what is God's message through Bilaam? The message, again, is that you cannot curse those who God does not curse. And also, the reasoning for the curse is because of the matriarchs and patriarchs. And second, because the Jews do mitzvos. So what is the message?
Doesn't seem to be that cursing doesn't work, but it seems to be that cursing these people in particular won't work. That's not the only reason.
Well, I heard what you just said, but I didn't sound like you were addressing me, but I heard with the point that you said. And it's true what you said, that is something, that is part of the message, that don't think that cursing is something which is a reality. Meaning the first thing that has to really be addressed over here is the underlying premise of what cursing is. So when he says that the Jews are not cursed by God, he's telling them the most primary lesson about cursing. There's no way to change the fate, which is basically, if you want to define what a curse is, it means that you can utter something, and that's going to change the fate of a certain person or people. But he sees now, the first message is to Balak that is a completely wrong concept of curse. God is the only one that can do that can change the fate. And since God has not cursed them, Ma'akov lo kavakel, who can curse those who God did not curse? Meaning, if it's not God's will to curse, so therefore, it's an impossibility. He's trying to correct them on the very premise of what a curse is, which makes sense, because that is the primary misconception that Balak has. Right? So the very message, like you were just saying, is that it has to be the first thing. The whole matter here is about cursing, so therefore, let's understand and examine what the terms are. What exactly is curse? I remember years ago when Rabbi Chaitman gave me classes, and he was mentioning Aristotle, so, you know, I took a look, and he talks there, and Rabbi Chaitman had given, I think the initial classes on it were following the order of Aristotle's book, and that is the first thing in Aristotle's book was defining the principles. I mean, defining the terms. Before you can address a matter, you first have to define what the terms are that you're going to use. You have to, you know, make clear the terms that we are now going to engage in our speech. What do these terms mean? So here also, it's not just the terms, but now the very topic is cursing. So therefore, the first thing that is being addressed is you have the wrong concept, Balak, about what cursing is. It's something which is only through God. So that's the first statement. But then the second statement is regarding the Jews, that they have the patriarchs and matriarchs, and they also have mitzvos. And it's explaining now why the Jews were not fit for a curse. All right. So now what happens is, right, so he ends off his first prophecy and he says, my soul should die the death of them, and my end should be just like them. So Balak is very upset. He says, I've taken you to curse them, and you bless them? So Bilam defends himself. He says, no, it's that which God puts in my mouth, that's what I'm going to guard to speak, like he's righteous. I can't do anything against my God. You know, he's putting on this affront. So then Balak says in 23:13, and he says to Bilam, let's go. Come with me. Let's go to a different spot where you can see the Jews. You can look at them. Because maybe you only were able to see a portion of the entire encampment, but all of them you didn't see. So you see, you know, Balak has this theory that in order to curse them, you have to be able to look at all of them. So, you know, of course, this is just based on nonsense. But this is his feeling. But evidently he doesn't listen to the message. And Bilaam himself goes along with it. You see, Bilaam, after the prophecy is over, like Rebbe Chaya explained, that Bilaam was, you know, as he had the prophecy, it was true ideas. But once the prophecy ended, he slipped right back into his wicked state. And he went along with Balak to try to curse the Jews.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is it that he saw the whole nation the first time and part of it the second time, or the other way around?
The other way around. That was Bullock's assumption. He says, maybe you didn't see everybody the first time. Let's try a second attempt at cursing them and stand on a different, you know, plateau where you can see all of them. And maybe that will give you the ability.
So I'm confused then by verse 13.
Yeah. Okay, he says, come with me to a different place from where you can now see, where you can see them. Because perhaps a portion you saw right now, but all of them you didn't see right now this first time. And now you'll curse with me again from there, from the new place, which you can see all the Jews.
Wow. The translation that I have is, go now with me to a different place from which you will see them. However, you will see its edge, but not see all of it, and you will curse it from me from there. So they have it as exactly the opposite.
Uh-huh. Well, let's make sure I'm not incorrect. Let me just take a look. Check one other translation. One second. Yeah, another translation I have has it like you have it.
That's interesting. Well, and, you know, verse 41 in the previous chapter supports your position, because it says, from there he saw the edge of the people.
Uh-huh. Verse, so that was the first time.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense, too, that, you know, if you see more, you can do more.
Yeah.
If you just see less, it just intuitively doesn't go. Either way, what does he do the second time? He says to him, yeah, so the second time is now 23:18. He says, what's the first thing he says? Actually, 19 is the first message. So 23:19, he says, God is not a man that he should lie, or the son of man that he should repent, meaning repent on what he stated. What he states, he shall not do. Shall he speak and not fulfill it? And behold, I have been taken to bless. Should I not return a blessing? Meaning my mouth, that's what he's saying to him. And then he says in 21, there is not seen any iniquity in Jacob, and there is no sin in Israel. God is God, their God is with them, and the truest Melech Bo. Which Unkelus translates to mean the dwelling of, I mean, the presence of God, His providence is with them. And he goes on to 23. There is no black magic in Jacob, and there is no conjuring in Israel. All right, so let's stop here. This is now the second message. The first thing he says is very interesting. He says that God does not lie and he doesn't repent from his words. Why is he saying this?
Maybe to emphasize that, you know, just by moving me to a different place doesn't mean God's going to change his message.
Right, so he's addressing the flaw of Bilam, which supports the concept that each one of these subsequent messages from God is now, it's in flux, meaning depending on how Balak responds, that's what the next message is. So it's not that all three have to be delivered to Balak, but God is now communicating, trying to give some corrective ideas over here, and that's what a prophecy is to give true ideas. So now the ideas are now in response to what he just did. And Ibn Ezra says what he just said. He says, what's the reason why God sends a prophecy now that God does not lie? Because on account of the fact that that the king Balak now says, curse them for me from now this new place. So what he said that, but he was already told that God does not curse the Jews. So since he was already told in the first prophecy that God does not curse the Jews, his attempt now to go to a different place is now assuming something incorrect about God, that the God has some change that he can go through. He's going to change his mind. So this is now a very important lesson. This is actually a pasuk in Malachi. It's 3:6. I was just looking at it the other day. Malachi 3:6, God says, I am God, I do not change. The concept behind God not changing is that since he is perfect and he is not ignorant, I mean, he's omniscient, he has complete knowledge, nothing could be a new consideration that he'd have to change his mind. So the concept of God never changing, first of all, it's when something is perfect, there's no change can take place in it. And change is also something which is this transition. I think we say that it's only change in the physical world. That the physical world can go through change because change educates time, and it's predicated on the fact that a change can take place. It means there's one event and there's a subsequent event. And there's something altered between the two events. So when you have two events and there's an alteration between the two, that is the definition of change. But that has to take place in time, and God is above time. Time is a creation, as Maimonides teaches. But that's just in terms of God's nature is impossible, in terms of his perfection. So that which is perfect remains perfect, and there's no change. That's why he says, I am God, I do not change. But also, the only need for change in how we view it is if there is something which you did not anticipate, and now you have to change your plans to accommodate. But that's impossible with God since he knows everything. So this was a lesson now being taught to Balak, based on his second attempt to curse after he was already told. The Jews are blessed, that's it. They have the patriarchs and the mitzvahs. And because of this, God does not curse them. So now he wanted to change that. So he has to be taught, no, there's no change here. God has all the facts. You're making a mistake. You're projecting human qualities onto God by assuming that God can change just like a human being can change. All right, so it's a very important idea. So that's what the first thing he says now is, God is not a man that he should change. You see, he says that message, Lo Ish Kael. God is not a man. That's the very message, like we just said. You are projecting human qualities onto God. That God is not human, and he's not the son of man. So he stresses that twice, that is the problem. So you see how beautiful it is that it isolates the very issue, the very underlying notion that Balak had, that he assumed that, well, maybe I can get God to change. No, you're assuming something wrong about God. Okay. But now he introduces also in 21, in 23, verse 21, he says there's no sin in Jacob or in Israel. Why does he bring sin in?
Maybe because if Balak's idea is that if he could find some sin in the nation, that that would be a pretext for being able to curse them.
Right, or, right, you could say that, or you can also say that since it is God's, we already at the outset said that God is the only one that can change the fate of the people, but since these people are loyal to God, and that's what the no sin means, the fact that they're loyal. When you're not sinning, that means you're following exactly what God wants. So since that loyalty exists, so now there's no basis by which you should say that God should now turn on them. She's giving them another. Not only is it because that they have the patriarchs, and not only because they have the mitzvahs, but also because they don't sin. It's a third step in that ladder, meaning God had selected the people because they were a monotheistic, and they selected him alone. That was the significance of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. So that was the first thing Bilam says to them, why these people are not going to be cursed, because they are the very ones that have selected me. So they are perfectly in line with me, as opposed to the rest of the world. That's what it means, the avos, the patriarchs and the matriarchs. That was their distinction. Right? Abraham had found God, and the rest of the world was still following idolatry. So the first and the most primary reason why God favors is because the Jews is because these patriarchs and matriarchs were loyal to the only true God. And by definition, that loyalty shields them from anything that can harm them. No fate, no change of fate, meaning no curse, can take hold, because since every curse is from God, and they're loyal to him, so that's it. That seals your fate for good. So that's the first statement. The next statement, that they follow the mitzvot, they follow the commands, whatever few commands they had, that teaches that not only were the founding fathers and mothers loyal to God, but then they followed what he said, meaning they took his direction and stayed loyal. Subsequent. So the inception of the people was loyalty to God, to the only one that could curse, and since they were loyal to him, so cursing is not fitting. And they followed his will for them too. So meaning the continuum of their existence was loyal. So it wasn't just at the outset, the founders, but the continued people followed the mitzvot. So that's a timeline, so that comes second. And third in the timeline is when he says now that there's no sin. They remain loyal and they don't violate. Nothing can invite God's disgust for them because they are being true to his system. Okay. And he says something interesting now. He says, God, who it's 23:22, he says, God took them out from Egypt. With great strength. And now he says, 23:23, there is no witchcraft, none of this nonsense, none of this conjuring or witchcraft is in Israel. So what is it bringing that in for? Why is Bilam now, why is God sending this message through Bilam to tell Balak that there's no witchcraft in Israel? What does that have to do with this?
Could it be that he is likening what Balak is trying to do with witchcraft?
Perfect. Perfect. Exactly. Meaning that you feel that there's some way now, if God's will is not to curse them, now you still want to, that means by definition you must be assuming some other means besides God that we can now affect the Jews negatively. So it's sort of like the other side of the coin of where you first said God does not lie. We already told you first time, Balak, that the Jews are blessed Now a second time you want to curse them? Well, you were just told. So first thing, he tells them God doesn't change his mind. God doesn't lie. But additionally, there is no other... Even if you don't abide by God, but then you might be assuming that there's some other forces out there that can cause your curse. That's not true either. And you see that this is something which strikes a chord in him. Because look at 27, the third time. So Balak says to Bilam, come with me and we'll go to another place. Perhaps from there will be good in God's eyes. Ah, this is something new. This is something new. Now Balak says, let's do something which maybe is good in God's eyes. So it took some hold on him. The point that there's nothing outside of God, and that there's none of this nichush, there's none of this conjuring in Israel. So that struck a chord evidently, because now Balak responded, well, let's see if we can get within God's approval to curse the Jews. All right, so there's nothing outside of God, so let's try to do something which will be good in God's eyes. You see? So you see from Balak's response that the something is taking effect over here, but still, ultimately, he still wants to curse the Jews. He doesn't ever accept that. That far, he doesn't go. The fact that they are blessed, he could never swallow. That is too much of a jagged pill for him. It fits in nicely, right?
Yes.
So it's clear that the attempts were made to, you know, open his eyes up to what cursing is, to help to find the matter, to show him how this is just a false premise that he has, and the reasons why. A lot of nice ideas in just a few verses over here. But you see also the very primary idea that prophecy is to try to educate a person, and all these attempts are trying to give Balak correct ideas. Give him a chance. Meaning that the lessons are, again, that only God can change their fate, and they are loyal to God. They became loyal by the founding fathers and mothers, and they kept the commands, and they didn't sin. And God is the only one that can curse. So therefore, you're not going to have any success. And there are no other forces. So don't think that there's any nachash. There's none of this belief of other forces in Israel. And they have the right ideas. So he's saying, since Israel has the right ideas, and they don't observe or subscribe to these theories of witchcraft or cursing or horoscopists, palm readers, all these different things the Jews don't follow, and God favors them, thus it must be that those things are all false. Why is God telling Balak that these things are false? Because precisely that is what Balak is trying to utilize. He's trying to harness an imagined type of system of cursing, which nothing exists outside of God. And he doesn't lie, there's no changing of God's mind. So the very primary ideas about Judaism right here in this this dialogue. And the concept that he's not like a son of man, that he will change his mind, again, driving home a beautiful point that this is where your error is coming from. It's a human quality, and you're projecting that onto God. God's not human. Man changes his mind, yes. God does not. Right? That's 23:19. He is not. God is not a man that he should lie. Or the son of man, that he should repent on what he said. If he speaks, will he not do? If he says something, he's not going to fulfill it? No. Nothing can come into the picture that alters his message. He's aware of everything. All considerations are there. So So this should give us strength in terms of that conviction that God's aware of all, and that He knows all, and He knows what's best for man, and that we should rely completely on Him. Of course, we do what we can, but we should have that satisfaction that if we want to have a good life, that we look to His advice, His counsel, and that He knows all, and He controls all, and there's nothing else out there. There are no other forces out there. I was discussing this point, I think it was over this past Shabbos, that in Maimonides he talks about, I think we may have discussed it as well, that in his Guides for the Perplexed. So Maimonides says, anytime a story in the Torah mentions an angel, so we know, he says, you should know for a surety that the entire account from beginning to end was a vision. So the question is, why? Why must it be that anytime there's an angel mentioned in a story in the Torah, that it did not take place on earth? It was not a physical phenomenon. It was a vision of some sort, a dream. I believe that's this very idea, that there is no other forces, there's no horoscopists, there's no demons running around, there are no other intelligences on earth except for man. Man is the only intelligence on earth. And if there's any story in the Torah which talks about an angel being seen or heard, I think we actually did discuss this last week, right? We touched on this. So if we ever find that, we know that it had to be a vision, because there are no other forces, there are no other intelligences on earth. So therefore it had to be a vision of some sort. It didn't take place in physical reality. So again, you see, that's a very important thing, because people's imagination is what creates these imaginary forces. They're looking for security. They're looking for things that will take care of them. They can't just embrace life and realize that they can, you know, go out and be independent. Because that's the childhood state that we come from, is being so dependent on our parents. People have a tough time really, you know, shedding that dependency and realizing that they have abilities that they can really exert. That's really the root of idolatry, the infantile state, that need for security and protection. What's the future going to hold for me? You know, let me read the horoscopes. You know, people that are fantastic in business, they'll still read the horoscopes, because when it comes to their emotional life, it's a dichotomy. Okay, any questions or comments?
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I never get at any point in this story that Balaam is threatened at all for his life or anything by not going along with what Balak requests.
Yeah, it doesn't seem he is. He seems pretty sure of himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he keeps on throwing up this, front, you know, my God, I can't go against my God's word, this and that. But meanwhile, he too wants to curse the Jews, even after he says this prophecy with his own mouth. But who can curse those who God has not cursed? That was the first prophecy. And yet, after that, two more times he tried to curse them. So, but he feels righteous, and he feels that Balak is dependent upon him, so that's perhaps where he felt that sense of security. Is interesting. All right, it's clear?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Very interesting. I've never seen those ideas from those three responses. Never connected that as responding to Balak's incorrect notion.
Yeah, it was only an assumption that I had last week, but then when I looked through the verses, it seems to really prove it. Especially where he says in verse, was it 23, 27, where he says, let's curse a third time, perhaps it'll be good in God's eyes this time. So you see that he's responding to the messages, and he's incorporating that into his next attempt. And each successive prophecy seems to be addressing something about Balak's incorrect notions. Yeah, because those are the only two possibilities. Either all of these prophecies were planned from the outset, Or they weren't, but they were in response to the current notions that Bullock was espousing, that he was subscribing to it at that moment. But that's how it works. I mean, that's how God works always. God knew that Adam was going to eat from the tree of life, and from the tree of knowledge. But he didn't give him any punishment until he did it. He only responded to him and his wife once they did it. Because it would be unjust to respond to something that did not take place yet. You can't punish a person until they've sinned. So God is always right there, ready to respond, but he does not step in until the person does something. He may try to help a person, like he tried to talk Adam's son, Cain, out of killing his brother Abel. But he doesn't punish him until he actually kills him. And even with the punishment, what he gave to Adam, so initially he says, you're going to eat the grass of the field. That's going to be your punishment. So the Talmud comes in, and it says that I and my donkey are going to eat from the same eating trough. It was just too much of too debilitating to his ego to have to be identified with an animal. So then God said, he gave him a compromise, and he said, okay, by the sweat of your brow you will eat bread. So he gave him food that was dignified, something that he would make with his hands as a response. The best thing would have been to stay with the donkey, to eat, really to subordinate his ego to the level of an animal. But that would not work. So based on, again, another response of Adam, so God steps in again and gives a compromise. He does an act of kindness and allows them some level of dignity. By the sweat of your brow, meaning through the creation of your own hands, allow you to invest some dignity in some ego into your eating. That was an important thing. What man eats is not to be the same thing as what an animal eats. It was just too base for him to accept. So here also, God responds only after Bilam and Balak say something. So it's part of how God works.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I noticed in reading through the whole story that I think not every place, but in a number of places, when Bilam speaks, he gives this sort of lofty personal introduction. The words of Bilam, son of Beor, the words of the man with the open eye, the words of one who hears the sayings of God, who sees the visions of God while fallen and with uncovered eyes. I don't recall, but I could be wrong, that any other prophet discussed in the Tanakh introduces himself with such lofty platitudes. Do the commentators comment on this, and is this just a reflection of the fact that this guy has a huge ego?
I would say this is ego, because this is part of what he's saying. This is part of the prophecy. I believe it's part of the prophecy.
Okay.
I didn't study that part of it, though. I can't respond to that.
Okay.
As you were asking the question, I was wondering if that since he was really wicked, so there had to be an intro that he's actually saying God's words. So he says that, like in 24:16. So speaks the one who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the One on High. The vision of God he sees, fallen down with open eyes. Because the Jewish prophet who's in line with God, it's known that he's following God. But this is an aberration where it was a wicked person. So perhaps it's necessary that at the commencement, part of the prophecy is that he's actually, it's not him, but it's God. And he's emphasizing the fact that he is going against his nature as a wicked person. I don't know, they would have to, have to research that to see. I know that the Rabbit Shade last year, I believe, I think it's on the I think it's on the YBT site to take a look. He had a number of classes on Billum, which I'm intent on listening to sometime during the week. So you can take a listen to that as well. I'm sure it's going to be very interesting. I think he must have done about 4 classes last year on Billum. So you can take a look at the YBT.org site and look under the audio classes, and it should be listed there.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. All right. Any other questions?
None here. That's really a very interesting progression of ideas.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure, sure. All right. Okay, so maybe we'll do, if you want, I was taking a look at a piece of the Talmud. Interesting, I mentioned earlier, for next week, the Talmud is it's in Avodah Zarah, and it's 24, excuse me, no, it's a, let me see here, Avodah Zarah, 54b. And it talks about a little bit of history of a dialogue between the Romans and the rabbis in Rome regarding idolatry. So if you want to just take a look at that one Mishnah. So maybe we'll do that next week. Interesting dialogue regarding idolatry. If it works, it doesn't work, and so what's God's response if it doesn't work? And if you're up to it, you could read from there. It starts halfway through on 54b in Avodah Zarah, the tractate on idolatry. And it goes through to the next page, just before the bottom, 55a. So you'll find it very interesting reading. Very interesting. It's pretty much historical with a few ideas thrown in. But it's nice when you have these little captured dialogues, from 2,000 years ago, and you see exactly how the rabbis responded, and you can study them. I just actually came across a book yesterday. I was at a friend's house, and he had this book in Maimonides, and I'm reading it, and it has this history about Maimonides' father, and he had a couple of dreams that were the same dream that was telling him to marry a certain woman, and he did, and he found this butcher by that name, and he had a daughter available, and he married her, and from that union, Maimonides was born. Amazing stories I never heard of before. But look at the documentation, and it seems to be that the author writes that there's quite a bit of manuscripts that give a very rich history of Maimonides, and even his father. So I'm looking through that, so if I'll share that with you as we go along. It's very interesting work. The book itself, let me just get it so I can tell you the name of the author. You may want to get it too. The book is called The Rambam, The Story of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon. It's by Yaakov David Shulman. It's put out by CIS, is the name of the publishing company, I guess. CIS Publishers. So, The Rambam, The Story of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, by Yaakov David Shulman, S-H-U-L-M-A-N. So far, I just started reading the first couple of pages, very, very interesting, really detailed, historically. All right. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up then. We're on for next week, though, right?
That's correct.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Rabbi. We appreciate it a lot. This is great.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Okay, have a good day.
Week.
Good week, everybody.
Thank you, too. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay. Okay, that'll wrap it up today. If anybody missed any part of the class, we'll put it online on the audio section very shortly so you can hear the entire class from the beginning. Until next week, we'll have a good one, and we'll resume again 11:15 next Sunday morning. That's New York time. Okay, good week to everybody.